Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to the latest weekly These Football Times podcast. I'm Aidan Williams. I'm here again with a couple of familiar voices from a little bit further back, and it's great to welcome them back on the pods again. So we've got Stephen Bell with us. How are you doing, Stephen?
I'm good, Aid. Great to be back. Thank you.
Good stuff. And Matthew Gibbs as well, another voice from a little bit further ago. And it's great to have you back again, Matthew, as well.
Yeah, it's been a while. Thanks for having me back.
Excellent, excellent. So we shall crack on with our weekly chat of all things football. Who shall I pick on? Stephen, why don't you just kick us off this time, right?
Little bit troubling from my local area, really. My local team is Huddersfield Town, and I've found it quite staggering. Not too surprising, unfortunately, the way it's gone this season after the end of last season, but really sort of staggering difference in the way that the future looks for the club now as to what it might have looked on a sunny afternoon there at Wembley not too long ago. They were really coming into the game at 1-0 down against Forest, the playoff final. Two, I think I would use the word arguable, but I don't think it is very arguable, really. In fact, I didn't see too many points being made to say that they weren't Stonewall penalties that day. Two got turned down, one in particular that went to VAR and was subsequently turned away by VAR. I think that was probably an example of the referee on the day almost leaving it up to VAR. Such a big decision at such a huge time. Probably wanted VAR to make the decision for him. Unfortunately, the rules that they are governed by with the clear and obvious error airs the VAR to always agree with the referee. The referee had actually booked Ari Toffolo for diving at the time, which I think also put him off overturning the decision. And they were really sort of coming into the game, being on top in the game. You would have really fancied them to kick on and win that playoff final. They had gone into the season as favourites for relegation last season. They had such an amazing season with Carlos Carberon, a young manager, sort of schooled in the Marcelo Bielsa way. A young team, really overachieved. You would have really fancied them to kick on, carry on that momentum and really have a strong start into a Premier League season, really, if it had kept the team together, which I'm sure he would have done, added to it a little bit. As it turned out, ironically, the two players... penalty decisions turned down. Ari Toffolo and Lewis O'Brien, the two best players, went off to Forest. They undoubtedly deserve a crack at the Premier League. No investment in the club. There's all kinds of wranglings going off behind the club as ownership gets passed backwards and forwards between from Dean Oyle and back to Dean Oyle, and it takes various steps forward and back within the club. And now they find themselves rock bottom of the Championship. Don't know where the next point is coming from. Carlos Carberon moved on, frustrated with the lack of investment, frustrated with the ongoing behind-the-scenes turmoil at the club. And now they really look almost certain, touch what I hope it doesn't happen, but almost certain that they'll be starting next season in League One, when there are a good chance that that's going to be a two-division difference from where they possibly could have been if that one or the other decision had gone the other way. Struggling to think of a time when I think a decision or a bit of bad luck, a one-off bit of bad luck, has had such almost a catastrophic effect. I mean, it has wider effect than just a club at a town like this. The club is very central to the town. So much passing trade is brought in by the success or lack thereof of the football club. And yeah, it's staggering, really, that a decision such as that can have such a profound effect on a club and even the wider town. So yeah, I were interested to know if anybody could think of a time when something like that has had such a disparaging effect on a club.
That's a hard one. That's a hard one. I guess as a first thing, for you, Steve, well, I'm just giving myself more thinking time here. You'll soon realise. But you know, how do you feel when you see Nottingham Forest? Because obviously they're struggling. They're at the bottom of the Premier League table. Okay, Huddersfield are at the bottom of the Championship, but Forest are very much bottom of the Premier League as well. I mean, who knows whether it would have been any different for Huddersfield, but you know, that could have been you, that could have been your team or your local team. Does their struggles make it harder to bear in some way, because it's like, well, maybe we'd have done better.
I think so, just because I'm quite certain that it would have been managed completely differently. Forest have seemed to have gone down the route of just throw a lot of money at it, sign a lot of players and hope that some of them find the feet, hit the ground running. And at the minute, other than a couple of good results, that hasn't happened. I'm quite certain that Huddersfield wouldn't have gone down that route. They wouldn't have had the money to go down that route. I think they would have very much stuck with the same starting 11 that started pretty consistently last season, probably with attempted to make one or two additions to that. So I think it would have been completely different. Difficult to guarantee whether it would have been any more successful or not. But yeah, I think if they'd have kicked on, if they'd have kept hold of the management structure, kept hold of more of the team, and they'd have been currently hovering around somewhere around the playoff positions, I think seeing Notts Forest bottom might have had an effect of, well, maybe we were better off waiting this extra 12 months, maybe. You know, that thought process could have come into it. But languishing down at the bottom, starting to see a gap emerging to second bottom, let alone fourth, it sort of doesn't give pause for much thought about anybody else.
It's true. I'm still trying to think of examples that have had such a turnaround. The only things that really spring to mind aren't quite the same kind of thing. So I'm thinking things like the West Ham Sheffield United situation of a few years back.
That's the one that springs to mind.
It's not a footballing decision, is it? But it's had such a big impact on, well, especially on Sheffield United, of course.
But it did for Sheffield United, I suppose, yeah. I've got what in the back of my head that for some reason I think it might have been Leeds and Everton, and I think it were a goal line technology one. I could be wrong, somebody might correct me. I seem to think that there was one of them teams, it could have been Leeds United, was scrambling around for Premier League survival, and there was a goal line technology goal. I think that's the one that it's scratching around in the back of my mind.
The other one that occurs to me is the Champions League semi-final ghost goal, as Mourinho would have put it, for Chelsea.
Yes.
Well, for Liverpool against Chelsea, sorry. And they went on to win the trophy that year, didn't they, Liverpool? So, Matthew, you can think of any.
Not quite the same, but in League Two last season, there was that incredible result on the last day of the season where Bristol Rovers beat Northampton 7-1.
Yeah.
And they sort of jumped over Northampton. Northampton went into the playoffs. Bristol Rovers went up automatically. Obviously, Northampton were absolutely rattled by it. They went out in the semi-finals of the playoffs, and I think I'd need to check, but I'm pretty sure they're somewhere down the bottom of League Two now as well. They've had like that. It's not quite the same because it's not a decision, but that obviously rattled them and knocked them really badly. I'm fairly sure the manager's been sacked a few weeks ago as well, so it's not quite the same. But things aren't particularly looking pretty rosy down there either.
Nothing in Birmingham's past that leaps controversy to you.
I mean, if you want to talk about the League Cup final in 2001, where David Ellery didn't give us a Stonewall penalty, and it would have been our second penalty of the game in the last minute of extra time, and you know, probably would have won. But I mean, there's plenty of stuff, plenty of controversies like that in our history. We do it to ourselves, to be honest.
Well, yes, I mean, we all cite things like that. I think that League Two one, that's a brilliant example, because that was just bizarre. The way the goals were just coming, it was all mostly second half as well.
And there was
it was just late on.
I can't remember the reason, but the game was delayed by like 15 minutes or something. Bristol Rovers had the chance to check the scores, and they knew that they had to score like at least another three goals to get to go up automatically. And there was, I should come prepared for it really, but there was definitely some controversy around that, and Northampton were really not happy after the game.
Brings some World Cup things to mind as well, doesn't it? So you've got like the Argentina-Peru thing of 78, I guess, has similar pattern to that of knowing what you needed to do and therefore having the means to go and get those goals by one way or another. The in a totally opposite way, the Austria-West Germany in 82, again, the things weren't at the same time. And I guess in a league situation, you can kick them all off at the same time. But if something happens, it's not so easy to end at the same time, and people might know what they need.
Yeah.
It makes it a bit harder.
That's it, yeah.
I got to add to it, though, about Huddersfield. Like, I do think it is one of the big tragedies about it is Danny Schofield being absolutely shafted by the club. Mm. Where they clearly went down the cheap route, didn't they?
Yeah.
Like they got Corberan left, and they decided, well, we don't want to go out and spend money on a manager, so promote Danny Schofield, who's a bit of a club legend, right? He's been at the club for like 15 years as a player, a coach, then a manager. And
yeah, a sacrificial lamb, unfortunately,
exactly,
for the situation. And for the the decisions that they made in the management structure, as you say, taking the cheap way, really, which is kind of what they're forced to do with that kind of club. You know, obviously the influx of money that a Premier League promotion would have got them had meant things would have been handled differently. But they took the same route with the playing staff. Any player that was looking for a move or able to move to a bigger club, a Premier League club, was let go relatively cheap. I think a lot of teams at the Huddersfield Town level, other clubs know that they're not going to be able to turn down any kind of reasonable offer. So that means that players tend to leave at the lower end of what you think that their valuation might be. Them two players in particular, I think, were valued particularly by the club. You know, the team was kind of built around them. They played down that left-hand side. And it's just one of them things that you looked at the management and playing squad 2 or 3 months after that FA, that year Wembley final, and it was almost unrecognisable. And unfortunately, what's happened since isn't a surprise because of that.
I mean, it's such a shame because, like, Carlos Corberan is a good coach, and I would say the Huddersfield Town squad last season wasn't great, but he had them. It's like a squad that is better than some of its parts, right? Like, Corberan has them playing in such a way that they pick up results. And it is a shame to see him down there. I mean, we played our first home game of the season. I'm a Birmingham City fan. Our first home game of the season was against Huddersfield, and they were a shadow of themselves from last season. They were
poor,
rubbish.
Poor,
and it was it's a shame to see, especially when it's like such a contentious decision that has that sort of impact.
Well, can they survive though, Steve? Can they? You know, that I see they're 5 points adrift at the bottom as we speak now, but. You know, the championship is notoriously even in many ways, and the results could come.
I think it's extremely unlikely, unfortunately, just because it's not just results, it's performances as well. And there's just that kind of feel about the club where you just can't really see a run of form happening. Hopefully it does, but it looks a million miles away at the minute.
Okay. Well, we'll come back and we'll hold you to this, Steve. So, you know, in May time when they're flying high and pushing for the playoffs. So.
We'll wrap it up in February. We'll wrap this discussion up in February, I think.
Yes. Okay. How about you, Matthew, then? What have you got for us?
Yeah. So, I didn't know which underdog story to choose from because there's quite a lot of fun stories happening across Europe with Osasuna in Champions League places in La Liga, Union Berlin top of, they might not be top of that. They got spanked today. They might not be top anymore, but they were top of the Bundesliga for.
They were a week ago, that's for sure. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. But I think across Europe, there's not many title races except in, I think this is like the third or fourth season in a row, that Italy, Serie A, is looking exciting and looking very tasty. Napoli are currently top with the scintillating Kvaratskhelia Kvaratskhelia, if I said that right. The Georgian Maradona, who is like where they found him from, I don't know, and he's just absolutely lighting up that division. He's been amazing. They've extended a bit of a lead at the top with around 35 points. AC Milan second, and then the team I want to talk about actually today is Atalanta. I think the most romantic club in modern football right now. I think. Ever since they appointed Gasperini in 2016, they've just been on a constant upward curve, taking them from sort of mid-table obscurity to consistently finish like record-breaking finishes. I think they finished third in the series in like two or three seasons in a row, with last season being the first sort of misstep where they finished eighth. But they've been doing this all while playing some of the most entertaining ultra-attacking football in Europe with smashing goals records. I think last season. Well, the season before, the only team that scored more of them in the whole of Europe was Bayern Munich, which I think speaks volumes about what they can do. And they've been doing this since Gasperini came, so it's six, seven years now. They've been doing this using quite unique recruitment tactics. They've spent some money, but it's nowhere near like what their rivals have spent. Like, look at Napoli, who had the money to spend 80 million euros on Victor Osimhen. But Atalanta tend to pick up players that have either failed at other clubs or haven't quite lived up to their potential. Prime example, Josip Iličić, who had all the potential. I think he was at Fiorentina before, but never quite did it. And he joins Atalanta alongside Papu Gomez, and they were the most consistently best players in Serie A for a number of years. Like I said, they're romantic. They're a provincial club based in Bergamo, who have to do things differently as they're located so close to Milan. They do this fantastic thing where when a new child is born in Bergamo, the club will send a kit, like a little baby kit, to the family. So the baby's first shirt is an Atalanta shirt, which is great. They're called the Queen of the Provinces because they've spent almost their entire history in Serie A, despite being a really quite small club compared to, you know, the giants that are around them. Really, really good history of bringing through players. You know, if we look at some of the best players in Europe now, like Kulusevski at Spurs, Manuel Locatelli at Juventus, all came through the youth academy. And I think what I think makes this season more interesting than some of the other ones is that they're adapted. And they've changed the way they approach games, which I think reflects really well on Gasperini. Before, they used to play this sort of ultra-attacking wing-back formation where it's just like, we're going to score more goals than you, and that's what they do. They like scoring, regularly getting 80 goals a season. But they lost a few players last season. I think it was Robert Gerzens went to Inter, Papu Gomez and Ilicic both left. Gallini and Romero went to, Christian Romero went to Spurs. So they lost the sort of the spine of their team, and they've had to adapt it slightly. So they're a bit more, not defensive, but there's a bit more of an emphasis on, you know, not conceding so many goals. They've gone back to what I think is the recruitment model that made them so effective. So they've signed some really exciting young kids like Brandon Soppy and Rasmus Højlund. And another who will be familiar to English fans in Ademola Lookman, who has already got 6 goals this season, which is the same as he got last season with Leicester. And yeah, I think they're still playing with 3 at the back with the wing-backs, but it's just a bit more structured. I don't think they're going to be competing for the Scudetto this season, which is a shame. I'm desperate for them to win something. I think they've been a fantastic side who have battling against the rich established elite of Italy, showing that there's another way to do things. So I'm really hoping that they get a Coppa Italia or something this year, because I think the Scudetto is just a little bit too far once again.
There is something nice about teams like, so you're talking there about, you know, it's so close to Milan. It's basically in the shadow of giants, really, isn't it? And it's like the little guy having to force their way into the reckoning. And so, as you rightly say, they've got to do it in a different way. And it's a little bit, I guess, the recruitment things and so on, or thinking a little differently. So maybe Brentford has a little bit of that in how to punch above their weight in terms of, you know, have to look at a different set of players or assess them in a different way because they can't afford in the same way that in Italy, Milan, Inter, Juventus, etc. can do. It enhances the story some way, doesn't it? And it's kind of pleasing. So many people like that kind of narrative, don't they? Of you know, the David beating the Goliath by whatever means. And, you know, hark back to that. How did David beat Goliath? He thought differently and had a different way of doing things. And that's exactly what this is. It's exactly the sporting equivalent, isn't it? And yeah. It's so heartwarming because it's football today is about money. Usually the league table pans out in order of who has the highest wage bills, top to bottom, give or take. But, you know, roughly it's along those ways, isn't it? It just shows the influence that money has. Doesn't have to be everything. And that it's really so nice. But I think in Atalanta's case, to actually do it in a particular style of play, you can punch above your weight in different ways. Look at Wimbledon years back. You know, they did it almost literally, shall we say, punching above their weight. You know, it was very physical, very robust, very Route 1. You know, that's the kind of thing that will galvanize their own fan base, but it won't really get the neutrals in the same way. To do this in such a stylistic way.
They have been maybe the most exciting team to watch in Europe for at least 3-4 years now. I mean, some of the football, it's so fast, and it's all about like getting the ball forward as quick as possible in any way possible. And they like they're not afraid to. I mean, what the things they do is they play with like not necessarily a target man, but big physical strikers. So they've had Zapata, they got Højlund this year, Luis Muriel, who's a bit of a battler. It's all about maximizing the players that they have. And I feel like I don't know this, I probably should have checked, but I think I wouldn't be surprised if they use like data, if they do take like a data approach to signing players, because some of the players they have are so. I don't know if you've ever seen Hatterball, one of the wingbacks, play football. He doesn't look like a footballer. He doesn't run or pass or do anything like a footballer. He's kind of awkward to watch. And they have a bunch of players like that, like Martin de Roon and Robin Gerzens to a point when he was there. And they're quite weird to watch because there's like a mishmash of techniques and styles, and it all just comes together, coalesces to make this just fantastic unit. It's like I said, it's a bit different this year where there've been quite a few ground out 1-0 wins, and they got beaten by Napoli last night, who I think Napoli look quite unstoppable at the minute, but they were quite unfortunate to lose that. I think they could have had a goal in the last minute, and I think it's just one of them where I think Napoli just have better players, unfortunately, and because of the change in style for Atalanta this year. They're not making as many chances as they did, but it's really heartwarming. And I think as long as Gasperini is there, and I really hope that he's going to be there for another few years, and I think he'll constantly be challenging that top four. And I'm just praying for them to win something. I just want a Coppa Italia, do something like that, because they deserve the success. They deserve to show, like you say, that you can do things differently and it can work.
Yeah, I've got a lot of admiration for any story like that. And I think that what you were saying there about, you wonder if there is something going on behind the scenes where how they identify players. I would be willing to bet that as much of that is about their abilities on the pitch as it is the personalities off it. There is zero prima donna going on there. There's nothing like that. There's no hint of a mercenary, and they don't ever seem tempted to go and buy a big name player who might have that negative effect on the dressing room. I think they seem to stay well clear of that. And a lot of clubs do that now. I think it's football's evolved in many ways negatively in terms of that, in terms of player power. A club can be derailed somewhat by getting a bad egg in the camp, and they seem to stay clear of that. And I've got a lot of admiration for that. Just going back to what I think is now a similar story, it's ironic because 10 years ago, you'd never have dreamt that a club like this would be talked about in that way. But I'll put Arsenal in there. You know, they've done things the right way. They've stuck with an ethos. They've stuck with a philosophy. It would have been so easy for them to push the panic button on Arteta a few times over the last couple of years. They never have. They've stuck with it, signed the right players, and they're really, really looking strong now. And I've got a lot of admiration for that. You know, you look at what Man United have done, and it's been very much go down the short-term, let's try and get success back by any means necessary. And that's gone down the route of both mercenaries as managers and players. And they always look, every individual player as well as the team as a whole, not so much this season, a bit better this season, a bit of an improvement this season, but they look like they're playing with the weight of the world on the shoulders, you know. And I think that's because there's that almost insistence that you must win the next game, you must do better than what you've been doing for the last so many years. There's not an into that at a club like Atalanta, and I think Arsenal have managed to almost wash that expectancy off of themselves, and it's given them a freedom to play better. You know, your Arsenal TV guys aren't getting as much airtime anymore all of a sudden because because that expectancy is gone, and they've managed to ride through that. They're a club that balances the books. Then if they were throwing money at it, they were never going to be able to compete with the likes of Manchester City. So why go down that route? Let's stick to this model that we know, that you could argue that they did for years under Wenger. And I'm pleased for them that it's starting to pay off. You know, everybody loves an underdog story. I think especially in the day and age of money dominating football, everybody loves to see the money bags clubs, especially the ones that are sort of state-owned and things like that. And I can see you smirking now, Aid, because obviously you've got a bit of skin in that game now, haven't you? But yeah, actually, going on to that, just as we're having a discussion, I don't think that's certainly not up to Newcastle yet, because I think everybody still, it wouldn't take long for it to go the other way, I don't think, if they did throw the money at it in the wrong way. But at the minute, with Eddie Howe in charge and keeping that same band of players together and just genuinely getting the best out of them, there seems to still be a lot of goodwill behind the Newcastle project at the minute. I'm not sure how long that might last for if they did spend $200 million in a transfer window in January or something like that. I'm not sure. but at the minute, yeah, they certainly haven't turned me off them like Manchester City and Paris Saint-Germain did almost instantly yet.
Oh, I think it started. I think there is a fair bit of it. Maybe it depends where you look. Mm. But I think that there's various newspapers or journalists or pods where every time Newcastle are mentioned, so is that, and rightly so. I think it should be, because it's obviously a huge, huge thing. And I think, yeah, that there is already, maybe not wholesale like it has become with, say, City or PSG, but it'll get there. There's a definite groundswell, if you like, of wanting them to fail, obviously, you know, and understandably so. I don't feel slighted in any least as a Newcastle person by that, because I think that's kind of what you've what you've bought into in a way, or been sold into, or however to term it. You know, it's not what the fans chose or wanted, but many have welcomed it because it's money. And, you know, that's what people worship, isn't it?
I think Miguel Almirón's smiling, boyish good looks being the front page of it at the minute is probably hiding a few sins for them, because everybody's enjoying his personal story, I think, as a sideline of it.
Yeah, you can't help but warm to someone like him and Joe Linton too, I guess, so fitting on that category. But, you know, it's a behemoth now. It's a whole different thing to what it was. It's all very weird. You know, Matthew, we've talked about this before, haven't we?
I do remember that one.
Yeah, exactly. We got into it a lot. And, you know, the conflict is still there because, you know, in your mind, it's the club I've been with all this time. So here's a little bit of success at last, or, you know, relative success. But it's like, how has it happened? And it doesn't feel right.
So it's always going to have that asterisk next to it, isn't it? I guess, you know.
Always, yeah, exactly, always. All right. I mean, going back to Atalanta, you know, from the sublime to the ridiculous, or the other way around, ridiculous to the sublime. Maybe it should be. I wonder, because we talked there, well, to relate it to Newcastle, that, you know, Eddie Howe's had this sort of impact on Newcastle as a club. Gasperini for Atalanta. I wonder, though, like some clubs and the manager, and you mentioned Stephen also with Arteta at Arsenal, you know, the manager is the club to some extent in many cases. You know, look at Wenger and Ferguson and so on at times, you know, the sheer force of will, personality and so on, that manager was bigger than anyone at the club over such a long period of time. I wonder for someone like Atalanta, if Gasperini did move on, what would happen? Would they just return back to their natural level? Which may still, as you say, Matthew, that's been Serie A for a long time, but it isn't up here in Serie A, is it? And, well, a couple of years ago in the lockdown Champions League, weren't they quite close to the latter stages? And it was only one leg stuff at that point, wasn't it? But I think it was a quarter final with PSG, if I'm remembering correctly, which would have been quite a close thing. I mean, that's what a mismatch that should be in terms of resource and wealth. But yeah, that's why I wonder about this situation like them, of whether they would drop back to their more natural level, or, you know, regress to their mean, I suppose, is the better way of looking at it, if he wasn't there.
I guess the thing about that is Gasperini is such a unique, like, he's quite a unique individual in football with the tactics that he plays with. Like, it's so ultra-attacking. I can't think of too many managers that play like that. I think one quite similar, I think, Roberto De Zerbi at Brighton. I mean, when he was Sassuolo manager, they were equally like, you know, all those myths about Serie A being defensive was absolutely thrown out the window if you watch like a Sassuolo or Atalanta game. But I would worry about that as well, because I don't know necessarily who's running the club. I know they did make an interesting appointment by getting, is it Lee Congerson from Leicester, who brought him in as the head of recruitment. I think he's on like a panel of like sporting directors or something like that. It would all depend who they brought in. And I mean, you'd expect the football to change slightly. You wouldn't expect it to be so ultra attacking. And I mean, the only reason we're having this discussion is about Gasperini, because if they'd appointed somebody else other than him, like they would not have had the same success, relative success as they've had, getting into the Champions League, like third place finishes. Yeah, you do sense that this is the Gasperini age, as opposed to it being a reflection on the club. I think it's sort of him and his tactics, and him working with the recruitment team to bring in this hodgepodge and mishmash of players from across the world. So you wouldn't expect them to be the same, to keep the same sort of level going, I don't think.
Yeah, possibly not. But for now, at least they're still sticking it to the man. They're well ahead of Juventus, which is, you know, that's got to be the best thing going.
I didn't know whether to focus, you know, talking about Serie A, to focus on the good of Atalanta or talk about how hilarious the situation for Juventus is right now. Them being down in eighth or seventh or wherever they are, looking rubbish and just playing the stodgiest football, couldn't happen to a nicer club.
Well, there we go. Yeah, we all take pleasure in that. It has to be said. Well, moving on then. I was going to have what I told you both I was going to talk about was FA Cups, but I've had a last minute change. However, I still will give a little shout out to the FA Cup first round of this weekend. You see, I was kind of hoping for a bit of northeast glory there with South Shields and Gateshead, but they both managed to lose. So there goes my opportunity to big up the northeast non-leagues. Even Hartlepool didn't even manage to beat Solihull Moors. So, you know, it's a bad weekend all round for the northeast there. Alverchurch, I guess, Southern League beating League One Cheltenham. That's a good one worth a shout out. Farnborough beating League Two Sutton United, former Giant Killers themselves. Kingsland at Doncaster and so on. But I think it's always pleasing to see those kind of upsets, but it didn't quite go with the narrative I was hoping for the weekend. So fortunately, last night I was channel hopping late night instead of going to bed when I should have done. And I was channel hopping and I stumbled across the MLS Cup final. Now, I'm not a great follower of MLS, but obviously an awareness of various individuals who've gone over there in recent times. And this MLS final was between Philadelphia Union and LAFC. Now, LAFC, of course, Gareth Bale's club, Giorgio Chiellini as well, for that matter, though he didn't actually make it onto the pitch yesterday. But I switched over onto this obscure channel and saw this going on. It was in extra time. It was 2-2, and it all looked rather dramatic and tense. The crowd looked absolutely amazing. It was a fabulous atmosphere, fabulous scene in Los Angeles. So they had the home field advantage, I suppose. And the crowd looked like they really got into the ultra style of support and fandom and so on. It looked absolutely terrific, absolutely bouncing. But this was a very, very dramatic game. There'd been a red card in extra time, which had resulted in not just a sending off for LA, but it was their goalkeeper, who was also one of Canada's goalkeepers for the World Cup. That might be a bit of a problem for them. But it led to a lengthy delay. As such, we were already past the 120-minute mark, still at 2-2. It was about 125th minute when Philadelphia Union scored. And so you think, well, this is it, done and dusted. They've won it. The crowd went quiet and it was all a bit sad. But then the 129th minute or so, cross comes in for LA. And who's there to head in another equaliser? Well, it's Gareth Bale, of course. Here comes the man for the moment. He'd come off the bench earlier on in the game, not presumably deemed fit enough or able to cope with the full game, but he came off the bench and when he was needed, he towered over the defenders. He powered in the header. 129th minute in extra time, running over the crowd, huge celebration. And of course, it went to penalties and LA ended up winning. Bale didn't end up taking one. Maybe it would have gone, but Philadelphia managed to miss all of there, so it was not really necessary. But this was quite a dramatic turn of events. But what it got me thinking, and this is what I really want to talk about after rambling on for 4 minutes or so already, is that Gareth Bale, obviously he's been a part-time footballer for some time. He essentially is holding out for Wales for the World Cup and has been for a while. Had they not qualified against Ukraine back in the summer, I suspect he might have called it a day then, but he didn't. And therefore he needed a club because Real Madrid weren't going to give him any game time. Or really let him go to any other bigger club. I mean, he needed somewhere to play. Now, Cardiff City was obviously mooted as a potential destination, people thought, or maybe just hoped. Maybe that was wishful thinking in some extent. But he's ended up in Los Angeles. I don't know how much good this will do him or not for the World Cup. I guess there's two ways to look at this. And one is that he's in a league where it's slightly less intense and less physical and less overbearing than perhaps it would have been in a Premier League or Championship club. Greater risk of injury and him missing out on his dream, I suppose. I can't say he's taking it easy because, you know, it's still a highly competitive league. It's a very good standard. It's just not quite as high as the top European leagues where he'd been playing. So in terms of ability, not the problem, even if he's on the downward slope. I guess it remains to be seen with Wales in a few weeks' time whether he can still be the man for the moment. I wonder how much impact he'll have when his fitness probably hasn't had the workout that it should have done. LA are using him as an impact player. Now, he's a hell of an impact player. Even if Wales use him for the last half hour of matches and he gets to take a few free kicks, maybe that's all they'll need to get through. Maybe that will be plenty and he'll have done his contribution. He did play full games for them in those playoffs qualifiers and, of course, was the key man, came through with the goals there. So maybe he does still have it in him. But you kind of wonder, has this extra 6 months down the line that the World Cup is now from where it might have been, whether he won't have quite the same edge, whether he's a little bit off the boil compared to what he might have been if he was still playing top level. And that's why it'd be quite interesting to see. So I kind of wonder what your guys' thoughts are on that, as well as this incredibly dramatic game.
I think Gareth Bale, as you've said, is almost preempting the World Cup, and he'll know his own body. And it feels to me like he spent almost the second phase of his career basing it around Wales and the big matches. I think it's easy when you're in mid-season for a big club, especially when he's playing for the likes of Real Madrid and he appears to be coasting a little bit. You know, there were a lot of the ill will towards him about spending far too much time on the golf course, not learning the language, all that kind of thing, especially when his performances didn't quite seem to match what they had at one time. But then magically, when he pulled on that Wales shirt, it was like rolling the years back and he'd find his absolute best form, which is absolutely scintillating. You know, he's one of those players where defenders just seem to bounce off him. He seems to be able to flick a switch and do something extraordinary almost at will when he's at his best. He still seems to be able to do that for Wales. I wouldn't put it past him at all to do something sensational at the World Cup, even if it's just one or two moments that get them over the line in big games and create some real memories. It's difficult for me to feel. I've been a huge Gareth Bale fan for a lot of years, and it's difficult for me to hold much ill will towards him about the way that he's managed himself and managed his body and his career. When he's won everything that he's won, when he's done everything that he's done, add them huge moments of contribution, especially for Real Madrid in them big games, you know, record number of trophies for a Brit abroad. And as a Welshman with a decent Wales squad that they only get once every three or four generations, that's actually good enough to qualify for tournaments and compete against your bigger nations when it counts, I can't blame him at all for actually wanting to capitalise on that and create something special. You could argue that he did that at the 2016 Euros when they got all the way to the semi-finals. That's something that I think that'll be a highlight of his career alongside any of the Champions League that he's won, any of the big moments for Real Madrid. And if he wants to create another moment like that at a World Cup on the biggest stage of them all, I hope he does it. And I think he'd be vindicated very much in the way that he's gone about his business this last few years if he did manage to do it. And based on his performance last night, I've watched the highlights. It appears that he's still got that moment in him very much. And yeah, it's even as an Englishman, I'll be very much hoping to see that kind of moment from Gareth Bale at the World Cup.
Well, he was certainly like the man on the spot at the right moment last night with that last 129th minute or so, as I say. I mean, it's incredible the game even goes on that long. But yeah, if anyone was going to be on the end of a header to secure taking it a penalty shootout, it was going to be him. And it's that kind of impact, isn't it, that he is capable of just flicking the switch, seemingly.
You mentioned you're not sure whether he'll be starting or not, or whether I think he'll be starting. Until something breaks down, he'll be on that pitch trying to get Wales the results that they need. He seems to be able to, you know, no matter how much of the downward slope of his career it is on or the accumulative effect of his injury woes for a lot of his career, he almost just seems to be able to, I don't know if it's mind over matter or what it is, but he manages to overcome it all when he pulls on that Wales shirt. I think that's been almost part of the problem. When he's gone back to Real Madrid and not done it, people think that he's almost picking and choosing. I prefer to look at that as a glass half full, in that he just manages to find something within him, an extra 10% that he can't do week in, week out for a club side. And so, yeah, I wish him all the best.
I mean, as someone has some skin in the game, I'm half Welsh, so we follow the Wales national team. My theory is that the whole him being used as a super sub is not the choice of LAFC, and I wonder if this is why he actually went to them over going to Cardiff, where the way American organizations in sport treat their star players is a bit different, right? Like they have a bit more say in how they're used and how, well, I mean, when they perform. So I like, it's totally like my own concoct theory, but I wonder if during the negotiations, he was like, listen, I am not being injured before the World Cup. I will come and I will play, but if I can be used like up until then sparingly or, and I mean, to be fair, he joined halfway through the season where LAFC were having a really good start to the year. So they are, I think I watch quite a lot of MLS because I think it's a crazy league. It's hilarious. But LAFC are one of the stronger teams in the division. They have quite a lot of designated players. And I mean, they're still playing with Carlos Vela, who is supreme in MLS up front. So there's also the thing that they might not have needed him so much because, I mean, they were going along pretty nicely already. So he's not a bad super sub to have. And just the joy that he has playing for Wales, I think there was no way he was missing this World Cup. So I really would be surprised if he was like in the negotiations, like, I am not playing that much for you. I'm not getting injured.
I wonder. Yeah, that's an intriguing thought. You may well be right, Matthew. I hadn't quite thought of it like that. But no, that does make a lot of sense because that's purely what the move was about, as we say. It's just keeping him ticking over, isn't it, for the World Cup. And then he's ready to unleash himself and fire in a few free kicks and dominate the air and do whatever he needs to do to get Wales out of the group. Yeah, wouldn't be surprised.
I just want to add on about the MLS as well, because I think it is one of the... It's such a weird league. I think if you ever... I don't know how much you watched of it last night. You just caught the end of it, right? They are the weirdest teams made up of... I think if you were to compare it to what we have in Britain, I'd say maybe it's more Championship League One level. And it's the football's not that good a standard. And then in the middle of a team, you'll have someone like Gareth Bale, who... like it's a team of quite average players and then just a couple of absolutely outstanding, brilliant players because they've been brought in on designated contracts. It makes for such weird games to watch. It's really engrossing. And it's a bit of a shame about last night, like Philadelphia Union are one of the teams in the league that don't really... I don't know how many designated players they have, but they don't have as much money as LAFC. So they were the underdogs going into it. So just from that angle, good for Bale, but a bit of a shame for the Union.
Yeah, exactly. A couple of their goals were from centre-back, a London-born guy. I can't even remember his name now. There's an English centre-back playing for Philadelphia Union, scored twice and still must be absolutely devastated to have ended up on the losing team.
Yeah. I think all of the goals came from set pieces as well, right? It was all headers into the box and stuff.
Pretty much. But it was dramatic and it just looked so fun and entertaining. Absolutely, absolutely great. Stephen, do you want us to roll us into the next section? Any things we're looking ahead to?
World Cup on the same subject really blends us in nicely, I suppose. Can't help getting away from, I know we've touched on it a little bit when we discussed Newcastle briefly, the sort of sports washing main event of all time is just around the corner. I'm just interested to get your guys' perspective on how it's going to affect your enjoyment of the World Cup, what your involvement will be compared to what it normally is. From my point, I'm still very conflicted, really. You know, and I know you personally, Aid, I mean, a long, ongoing, personal and passionate relationship with the World Cup. Same for me, as listeners who remember when I've been on previously, I probably know my love for the World Cup led to me going to Brazil for 6 weeks, which ultimately led to me writing my first book and sort of changed my life, really. So I feel obligated to have some negative feelings towards this, and I have got some very negative feelings towards this World Cup. But also don't feel like me, along with the millions of others of long and loyal World Cup fans, should be almost robbed of something that comes around once every 4 years. I keep getting slightly... it's a bit of a roller coaster ride going up to it. It seems to have come round very quickly all of a sudden, and then, you know, just this week I'm reading these reports that now Qatar are... look, it appears like they are funding fans to go, so long as they promote them in a positive way on social media. Not only that, more sinister than that, what's the quote I've got here? Report via screenshots any offensive, degrading or abusive comments that they see. Now, that it really starts to feel quite sinister at that point, and almost everything that I'd hoped it wouldn't be. Going into the Brazilian World Cup, and I also remember the South Africa one 4 years before that, the media was full of what I can only describe as quite scaremongering type stories about the host countries and particularly the large host cities, the crime rates and everything, the no-go areas and all that were very much publicised. And yet it feels like for this one, where if ever there was negative reports that should be happening about a host nation and things that go on there, it feels like it's been largely radio silence, which I can't help but feel ties into all this. And it feels very almost like FIFA and the old, going back to the Blatter years of when this was awarded to them. And yeah, it feels like it's been a bit of a roller coaster ride where I've managed to feel quite positive about it at times. If I do think that it could, because it could have gone the other way, you know, they could have reported heavily on the negatives around the country and the regime and the laws and things that we definitely want rid in the world. They could have used this, the media and the organisations without direct ties. I understand the ones with direct ties, they've got skin in the game. They probably shouldn't have, but they have. But the other media outlets could have used this as an opportunity to have the opposite effect to what Qatar won, and they could have highlighted things, really put pressure on, and it could have been a catalyst for change. And I just don't see that happening anymore. I think it's going to be very much rammed down your throat as a sports washing exercise. And that makes me very much not want to be involved. And so I'll be watching games not quite as passionately as I once might do. And that's probably where I'll be, just not quite feeling the same level of passion for it that I normally would, while still very much keeping my eye on it. So, yeah, over to you guys. What's your thoughts?
I know what you're saying on a lot of that, because, as you say, I'm a huge, huge World Cup fan. It's just, to me, it's the best sporting event. It's the biggest thing for football. I get more enjoyment out of that than I ever have with a club season. Which isn't what everyone thinks, but that's how I think. I think back to when this was awarded. This was in 2010. Now, since then, so that's 12 and a bit years ago. Since then, I've repeatedly thought it was going to get taken away from them as more and more of the murkiness, the dodgy dealings, the evidence of the corruption of how it was awarded has come to light. You know, there's been books written about this detailing it all. Going back several years now, none of them are relatively recent at all. This is going back a long way. All the evidence of how they won the vote. This is one side to it. Obviously, all the issues in Qatar is another side to it. But I think just on that whole, how they got it, I honestly can't believe that we're still here today now in 2022 and it's still going ahead in Qatar for all those reasons, let alone everything else. Add in the fact that they obviously had to bid on a summer tournament and they made all these promises about air conditioning, blah, 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 how it was all supposed to work. Well, it was never going to, you can air condition a stadium, but you can't air condition a country. How are the fans supposed to cope? How is anyone else supposed to cope? It was ludicrous. And yet all these things have come to light. All those broken promises have come to light and nothing changed at any point. There was never any realistic point of the pressure getting to a certain level that was going to get taken away for those reasons. Then we add in all the other reasons about Qatar, its society, how it treats people. There's all the things about the migrant workers, the construction sites, the LGBTQ rights, all of this stuff. It doesn't seem to make a dent in just the endless juggernaut that's leading us towards Qatar and the World Cup. The FIFA are blind to it, almost, to the extent that obviously Infantino just in last week sent a letter out to all the FAs competing saying, stick to football, please, no political statements, because they're presumably panicking a bit, I guess, of what may unfold. I mean, thankfully, I think I saw today that the English FA, Welsh FA, and a few other European or Western nation FAs have responded to that saying, well, no, we will make appropriate gestures or whatever it is. We're not going to be silenced by FIFA. And yet they're still going to be partially silenced because nobody's going to go and do some elaborate display of support for the people who aren't supported in Qatar.
Well,
I don't see that that's going to happen. You know, there's the armband gesture. But that's still, you know, it's an armband within the criteria that FIFA define. It's a one love statement. It's not some bigger, more elaborate thing, because that wouldn't be allowed. You know, political statements on a shirt aren't allowed. Political banners in a stadium aren't allowed. Things like that. The Socceroos did this excellent video a couple of weeks ago, didn't they? Talking at length about this and the personal feelings of a number of the players. That was fantastic. I highly doubt any such thing would come out during the tournament because there'd be bigger repercussions. Maybe I'm wrong. That'd be nice if I am. But equally, the sort of silence from other nations, no one else has done anything similar or a different gesture with a similar impact. Denmark, their kit is going to not have the brand showing so clearly on it. But you know, that's just a small thing because the brand doesn't want to be associated with it, but they still actually are the brand and it's still going to be there.
It's the biggest non-gesture ever.
Yeah, possibly so. And I don't know. It does feel weird that it's still happening. I honestly can't believe we've got the point 12 years after they award it and it is still Qatar for a whole host of reasons. Will I still be watching it? Yes, because as you say, Stephen, maybe I'm not strong-willed enough or principled enough and too big a hypocrite. I don't know. But selfishly, I want to enjoy the World Cup still. I love the World Cup and I want to watch it. And I want to enjoy everything that comes with watching a World Cup, whether that's getting carried away with your team and seeing how far they can go, whether it's appreciating the style of play coming from Brazil, Argentina, from Africa, from Korea and Son, if hopefully he's fit, things like this, you know, all this stuff. I love it all. I love it all. And to deny myself that when it's going on, that's more than I can actually manage and actually do. I could hide it under justification of saying my kids enjoy watching it, and they do, but really I want to as well. You know, let's be honest. it's some people I know are, not that I know personally, but I've seen comments that are going to avoid it because of stronger principles than I have. And that's great. That's, you know, all tip my hat to them. But I don't have that length, degree of conviction, I guess, because I love the World Cup and I want to watch it. The only saving grace to that can possibly be that more attention is focused on these issues. But as you say, Stephen, it's still a sports watching exercise. Nothing is materialistically changing. And as soon as the glare has gone after the World Cup, then it's gone. It's similar to a saying about the football club, Newcastle United or City and so on. The glare comes on intensely at the beginning. And for Qatar, it's going to be over the next 5-6 weeks. But then the glare goes away and it gradually becomes normalized. And that's where the sports washing wins. Soon we'll be just looking back at the magical moments that will no doubt happen on the field, the drama that will happen. It'll eventually become a distant memory of, well, it was a bit weird that it was in the winter and it was a bit weird that it was in this tiny country where all the stadiums were within 10 miles of each other or whatever it is. But look at what happened in this game. Look what happened in the final. Look who won it. That's what the memories will end up being. And that's where the sports watching wins. But yes, I will still be watching it. I think the anticipation isn't the same purely because it's a Winter World Cup, I think. Rather than these other issues, I think, as you say, there's always some issues. And I think this focus would have been the same had it been in the summer to now. The difference being that we don't have that period of anticipation, the sort of fallow 2 or 3 weeks that you normally have between the end of a club season and the start of a tournament. And that's where there's nothing happening. It's like a phony war. You know, there's a few friendlies. You're hoping nobody gets injured. You're seeing who gets in the squad, who doesn't. But it's all about the anticipation of what's coming at you a few weeks down the line, and you just can't wait to get to it. Whereas now, we're all still so focused on the club game, there's barely a moment to even consider that there's a World Cup so close on the horizon, and yet it is. And we've still got another week to go of the club season, and then it's only, 7 days later the World Cup starts. It's bizarre. It's really, really weird. And that, I think, is affecting a lot of how excited people are to watch it. The fact is, winter's going to change certain things anyway in terms of where people can watch it. There's not going to be the big outdoor fan parks and so on, at least if they are, you have to be rather hardy. It's going to be different from that perspective. But when it comes down to it, I think the whole issues with Qatar will, they'll pay lip service to it during the tournament, but it Yeah.
Actually, just tying in two of our separate points together, the radio silence that I talked about, I mentioned that I've been disappointed the spotlight hasn't yet come on Qatar enough. Actually, this winter timetable has probably helped that a lot, hasn't it? Because, as you say, everybody's still concentrating so much. There's usually that 2 or 3 week is very much intensity surrounding the build up to a tournament. And
We haven't had the whole panorama deep dive into Qatar that we might have had a few weeks for. Exactly.
So it could have actually all ended up tying in together. I'm not going to use the word conspiracy, but you know, who knows? who knows how well that's all been worked out. But yeah, I have been disappointed that it hasn't yet shone more of a light on it. You know, it could have been the moment that the world opened its eyes to this sort of stuff. That it's, you know, there's sort of stuff that's going on in the world that absolutely should not still be going on in the world in 2022, and it just feels like it's going to have the opposite effect, which is what I'm sure it's designed to do.
I mean, I'm not sure I agree about the radio silence stuff, because I mean, I know the Guardian have been doing a lot of quite interesting stuff about it. The Athletic have been doing some stuff, but the radio silence bit that I think speaks volumes about the World Cup is that I have seen no adverts on TV. I've seen no promotion, no nothing anywhere. You know, usually you get like a Coca-Cola advert, like doing with all the footballers involved, or Pepsi or whoever. And it's like, oh, get ready for Qatar 2022. I haven't seen anything. I think it's brands and companies and organizations know that this is a toxic World Cup and they don't want any association with it. So there's been nothing for it. And I mean, I just think there's just no positives about this World Cup whatsoever. There's just nothing. There's nothing to look forward to. There's nothing interesting about it. There's no, even down to, even down to the fact that it's been held basically in Doha, which I think I read somewhere is about the size of Dublin, which is, how can you host, infrastructurally speaking, how can you host a major tournament like this with thousands, hundreds of thousands of people coming from around the world in a city the size of Dublin? It doesn't make any sense, and especially in a country that has little to no football heritage at all, which is not the main reason to, you know, not be looking forward to the World Cup. But it's so strange that, it reeks of the corruption and conspiracy and stuff that it's been hosted in Qatar over any other country in Asia that has more of a football heritage. And I mean, even down to the football is going to be rubbish because everyone's knackered, everyone's injured. Like, how many injuries have we had this weekend in the last week? Like, people like Ben Chilwell and Heung-min Son maybe not making it to the World Cup.
The lack of preparation as well, I guess, comes into the standard of football we'll get to, doesn't it?
That first round of fixtures are going to be so boring because the players will have had no time with each other. They'll have seen each other like 5 days previously. They'll have had like 2 training sessions. There'll be no... I genuinely think the football is going to be of a really poor standard because there's going to be no preparation, and it's going to take until the round of 16 or something to have like really exciting football, because that'll be a bit more used to playing with each other. I think it's going to be a bad World Cup, and for so many reasons. And the fact that, when did the reports come out about how, was it about 6 years ago when the reports came out that Qatar had been illegally awarded or something like that? And like you said, there's been books written about it, and it's just kind of insane.
Definitely that, 5 or 6 years ago, I was reading a book detailing it all. It's been a long time.
It's obscene, but it shouldn't be a surprise. I mean, the World Cup has always been used as a vehicle for soft power, right? I mean, even going back to, is it Argentina in 1978, like how that was awarded and how that could have been hosted in the country, in the state.
Go back to Mussolini.
I mean, the World Cup has always been a vehicle for soft power and corruption.
We don't have to go that far back, do we? Where was the last World Cup? What's happened since. And they were in conflict with Ukraine then. Yeah, they were in conflict with Ukraine when it was awarded, maybe, or around that time when it first started. People knew about Putin already. They might act as though it's some major shock, a lot of people and outlets and politicians especially, but it's not. It wasn't a major shock. I remember the glowing reports that come out of Russia. Oh, what a wonderful country. I didn't know it was sunny in the summer. I remember all that coming out, and it worked for a short period of time, and who knows?
Yeah. I do think this might be a bit different, though. I think because there's not as much to do in Doha as there is, say, for example, in any of the other Russian cities that they had going on. There's a lot of people not going that would otherwise have been going. And it speaks volumes of FIFA, doesn't it? Like, how else do you want to tell the world that you don't care about, something as important as LGBTQ plus rights, as by awarding it to two countries in a row where it's illegal to be gay. So yeah, I think there's nothing to look forward to. I mean, I will probably watch it because the bare simple, I work from home. So I mean, I hope there's something to watch in the background, isn't it? but it's quite fortunate I'm going on holiday during it, so I will miss a bunch of it, and that's probably a good thing, I think. I mean, I think I previously came on a These Football Times podcast talking about the Russia World Cup and saying it was the one that we should have boycotted, the one that in hindsight everyone should have said no to, and that this is just like 10 times as worse.
Oh, it's another level. It's, yeah
depressing.
It is indeed. But hey, this is all, well, it will be on us very, very soon, 2 weeks from now as we record, which just feels astonishing, doesn't it? This is all making my next point rather trite, because I was going to talk about the fact England's squad announcement's coming up on Thursday. So yes, we're going from the serious back onto the football. But England's squad announcement is happening on Thursday. There is no boycott. It is all happening. With my slight Newcastle hat on as well, I was wanting to chat about the striking options to go alongside Harry Kane, not alongside in the lineup, but alongside him in the squad for England, because I think it's become a lot harder than it might have been not so long ago in terms of who's to go in. Now, to me, Callum Wilson, I think, even though he's not been in any squads for quite some time, is probably right up there with a chance, whereas he previously wouldn't have been. I think somebody like Rashford was out and is now right back in. Somebody with experience. I know he can play wide too, but he could also play through the middle if necessary. So he's another option. I think Ivan Toney, I wonder whether he's blotted his coffee book with the gambling issue that seems to have cropped up over the weekend now, that he's got himself, well, historically involved in, rather than something up and current. But I slightly worry for him of whether that'll actually impact his opportunity to be selected, because I think he would be. And, you know, if it ends up in a penalty shootout, you'd like him rather than anybody else, that's for sure. I don't know whether that'll have harmed it. If you'd asked me a few months ago, I'd have said, or maybe late last season, Tammy Abraham's a shoo-in, but perhaps not so much anymore. Equally, Dominic Calvert-Lewin has been in it so many times, but I think he's bottom of this particular pile now. Yet he's the one with more experience of these things than most of the rest of them, Rashford aside, I guess. So I guess the thought is, Harry Kane is obviously the one who's going to play, but who will they bring in to change things about? Who will they bring in to maybe have an impact in extra time or late on when England are struggling to break down Iran? Or after Gareth Bale has scored 2 free kicks against them and they really need something late on? However it's going to go, it doesn't seem so easy anymore to pick this position. My thoughts are that Rashford is going to end up in because he's found his form again. He's got vast experience at his young age of tournaments and international football. I think he'll be in. I think Toney will probably be in unless there's other reasons he can't be. And I think maybe Callum Wilson will, despite his fragile muscles. But I don't know. I don't know. It's not so clear. I wonder what you guys think of it.
I do agree with your point about Abraham, because I think he's a very good backup to have to Kane. He does a lot of similar things really well, yes. But he's not having the best season. At Roma, I think he's only got like 2 goals this season. And I think there's been a few, you know, in the Roma press, there's been a few complaints about his performances. I think there's two elements to this debate, though, because there's something like who you think should be in, and then there's who Southgate will take. Because Southgate is very loyal to his boys. So I think I agree with you, it would be Kane. I think Rashford will go just because Rashford is quite versatile and can, if you want to play him out wide, he can do that. Or he can play down the middle. I think he will go even though he's missed a few squads. And then I think Toney will be the one to miss out just because I think he's gone off the boil a little bit lately and he's never played for England before. He's only been in the one squad. So I can see Callum Wilson and Tammy Abraham making it, because it's a bigger squad, isn't it? It's like 27, is there 28 people in the final squad? So I wouldn't be surprised if there's a couple of strikers. But I think Toney will be the one to miss out. And I don't think Calvert-Lewin will be anywhere near that list, because he's nowhere near up to speed.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things to take into account. And that's the fact that mixing it up, i.e. an impact change is very much different than taking, I think, an understudy to Kane when you want to keep playing the same way. And Southgate's very much married to a style of play. So I think that Tammy Abraham is the one who would go as a starter in lieu of Kane, if anything were to happen to Kane. But I do think that Callum Wilson might be the one that gets the nod as an impact, more of an impact substitute type. And I massively agree that now Rashford is back on form. I did fear that we'd... I know he's still only young, but he's got a bit of miles on clock now. I did wonder if Rashford might find that form again. I did for a while think that he might move on from Man United and slowly sort of peter out a little bit at the very top level. But he seems to have found a little bit of something again, and I think is clearly a great influence around the dressing room. I think he's such a popular lad. The versatility will definitely go in his favour. So yeah, I think we're all sort of agreed that who will take and probably what we'll get used for. I think, as Matthew said, Southgate's very loyal. I don't think anybody's done enough to dislodge Sterling at one side and probably Saka at the other, and Foden probably floating around somewhere in there. And I know he obviously loves Mason Mount a little bit further back. So I do think it's going to be largely the same sort of team and playing style that we've seen so far from Southgate. It's just a matter of what we do if and when we get injuries and later on in the tournament, and when it's time when we need to actually attack.
Hopefully there'll be a bit more of Bellingham than in the past. Because I mean, now what Sancho was a year and a bit ago, wasn't he? You know, Sancho was tearing up the Bundesliga as we went into the Euros, and then he wasn't getting in the England team. He got little bit parts. He had a whole minute before his penalty in the shootout and things like that. You know, he didn't get the full opportunity that his form in Germany seemed to warrant. And Bellingham now, in recent internationals, has been getting more of a go, but is equally tearing up the Bundesliga like Sancho was before him. Hopefully he'll get a looking.
He's got to be a starter, I'd have thought. I mean, probably you would think he would slot in where he stole it, well, Calvin Phillips the last time, alongside Declan Rice. You'd think that that's got to be Jude Bellingham this time.
I think the one we haven't mentioned, who I saw reports over the weekend, is going to be, you know, the 55-man squad, the initial 55-man squad. Danny Welbeck has been included from Brighton. So I don't think he'll be going, but it's an interesting choice. I wonder if there might be a couple of surprises, not necessarily with the strikers, but I wonder if James Maddison's form is too good at the minute to ignore. And then I wonder if there might be a bit of a surprise inclusion in Marcus Edwards over at Sporting Lisbon, who is doing pretty exciting things, looking good in the Champions League. And with players like Sancho, who I don't think is going to make the squad, and a couple of the other wingers in Sterling, who is not in the best of form, maybe there will be like a surprise inclusion for someone like Marcus Edwards, who is, I think, doing good stuff.
Yeah, I'd love it, but I don't think Southgate's brave or bold enough, if I'm honest, for that kind of thing, especially if it comes down to starting. I'm pretty certain he'll stick with Sterling. And I kind of get it. You know, I don't think anybody in them positions has quite done enough to take that place that he has delivered for England.
We do have quite a lot of players out of form.
That's very true. He's maybe one that's just not... He's somebody in form at this time could have dislodged Sterling. I just don't think we've got it. I'm still so down about Jadon Sancho. I thought he were going to be the one that would really, really kick on again. I think it's that almost Man United curse at the minute, where players playing with the weight of the world on the shoulders. I think that's really had an effect on him. But
well, he's not the only one, is he? Harry Maguire's another one in that category. But less said about him, the better.
I think that's what it was with Rashford as well for a good period of time. Yeah. It were all right when there wasn't much expectation on him and he was the new kid on the block that were delivering. But as soon as he became a starter, that's when it just seemed to feel like it without pressure. And I do think that might just be...
Well, he and Sancho both had obviously that factor plus the major Euros hangover factor as well, of course, for what happened to them.
Yeah, didn't affect Saka though, did it, as much as he seems to have...
No.
Really kicked on from there.
But he was odd. But oddly, though, he was the one who was boosted everywhere he went. He was the one who was getting applauded at every ground, even at Spurs.
True.
Whereas I don't remember the same happening for Sancho and Rashford.
No, you're quite right.
The thing about Rashford that always kind of annoyed me with the the coverage of like when his form dipped is that he's been injured for years. He spoke in the press about how he was taking painkillers to play and that he basically hasn't been fit for about 3 years, which he's like a young man. He's, I don't know how old he is, 22, something like that.
Yeah.
Like 22, he's helped feed the kids in the country and still scored 100 goals for United in his career. And I don't know, I thought the coverage of him especially was very unfair. I think he was never used, especially with previous managers apart from before Ten Hag, but not used in the right way and how he should be used. So I'm really glad to see him back in form, to be honest, really glad. And
I think Mourinho is the main one for that, because he burst on the scene as a striker. And then I do feel that, obviously, depending on what generation you're from, I'm still just quite young enough to remember when 4-4-2 was a thing and strikers bursting up the scene, probably thought that that's what they were going to be. And then it did change. The football did change. 4-3-3, or certainly a front three became the option. And when that became the go-to thing, it always felt like it was the new kids on the block that would automatically, even though they'd been playing as strikers in the youth teams, scoring hatfuls of goals, they would be the ones that would be forced to break in playing wide. And then you do that with Mourinho as your manager and suddenly you'd be a left back, which I think that had an effect on Rashford as well. And as you say, the injuries did just lose that explosive pace a little bit, lost a bit of the surprise factor that he had when he first burst on the scene. And I did wonder if he'd get it back. And I know it's an ironic thing to say about somebody so young, but I'm just pleased that he did, as you say. Seems like a fantastic young lad. I think his reach outside of football is something that shouldn't be overlooked. And I think he's the epitome of the idiots that say they should stick to football. You know, he's the poster boy for not sticking to football.
That brings us right back to the Gianni Infantino point there. The idiots who say just stick to football. Anyway, now Stephen's pointed out on our chat alongside this that I totally missed the perfect opportunity to lead in from what Matthew was talking about Wales into the other point he wanted to make. So I've totally missed that elegant segue, and now it's a much more clumsy one. Go for it, Matthew.
It's just something to keep an eye on. I think something quite interesting is the Welsh FA are considering changing their official name to Cymru, the Welsh language name for that country. And I think it's a fascinating little example of how football can lead society, which I think is something that is overblown quite a lot. You know, you always hear football can lead society, acting like it's something different, something adjacent and not part of like society itself. But I think it's a good example of the links between football and nationalism. Like, nobody in Wales needs to be told that they're proud to be Welsh. It's a very proud country. I've got a lot of Welsh family. My mother's Welsh. Like, I've spent a lot of time there. They are prouder than anything to be Welsh. They don't need anyone to tell them that. But the recent success of the Welsh national team has kind of shone a spotlight on the sporting elements of the country and the pride that the Welsh people have in their cultural heritage. And I think a lot of the big moments in recent years have been really connected to that Welsh heritage and sort of the Welsh language. So before, I don't know if you guys remember, you will remember the famous game against Belgium at the Euros in 2016. That rendition of the national anthem before the game gives me goosebumps. You can go watch it on YouTube. It's amazing. And then more recently, there was, I'm going to butcher the Welsh language now, but David Iwan's performance of like his iconic song, Oma Hadid, before the Austrian World Cup qualifier was spine-tingling. That was amazing. And it's a Welsh language song that has become the national slogan and anthem for the national team. And I think it's one of the things where it wouldn't be that big a change, because the Welsh FA refer to themselves as Cymru in internal documents anyway. And it's very reflective of statistics showing that the Welsh language has gone from being a bit of a dying language to one of the fastest growing languages in the UK. So I think it's just another example of how football can help foster and protect important cultural heritage. And I mean, it brought to mind, which is, this is not the same, but there's a fantastic article in the Blizzard magazine from about 10 years ago, I think, about how the Scottish independence movement in 1978 was picking up steam, but that the national team, Scotland, had such a disastrous World Cup in Argentina, it totally derailed the independence movement, that the vote never went ahead. And if anyone can like search it out, it's a really good article. But I don't expect this to have the same effect. Like, if Wales didn't have a good World Cup, I don't think anything like that would change. I think they would still go ahead with the change. And I think it's one I hope happens. Very interesting example of how football can protect cultural heritage.
I think you're absolutely right, but I do think it's so strongly linked with the political landscape. I do not blame Wales and Scotland and Ireland at the minute for wanting to distance themselves from the Westminster shenanigans, especially post-Brexit. And I do think that that's gained momentum for patriotism in them countries, possibly seeping into nationalism, which, you know, you've always got to be careful that that gets kept, you know, sensible. But I've absolutely no problem with them distancing themselves at the minute. And if that's another way to do it, another way to show that they are proud Welshmen, as we know they are. I mean, the Michael Sheen clips recently, I mean, makes me want to be Welsh. You know, you should never say that about me. But I want to distance myself from the old Westminster stuff and the English stuff at the minute. And as I've been saying, I'm a bit of a Gareth Bale fanboy. I'll get a Cymru tattoo.
You make a good point, though, because I mean, like Wales is the anglicised name; it's the English name for the country. So, I mean, yes. why wouldn't they call themselves what they are? The country is actually called.
Absolutely. Yeah. Just do it for me. Yeah.
Turkey is another one that have done or tried to do this in recent times, aren't they? Of the changing the spelling,
of course, yeah.
Or maybe the pronunciation. I guess it's not quite the same level of essentially a completely different name word. For that, which we're talking about here with Wales and Cymru, it's, you know, Turkey to Turkey in a different spelling isn't quite the same, but it's still trying to make it Turkish rather than English, isn't it?
Yeah, I think
it's still the same. It's just less extreme of a change in terms of how it looks, I suppose. That's all I'm trying to say there, rather than compare levels of what's going on. I think it's totally understandable. The fear, if they go ahead and try to do this or to do it officially, and then I guess the trying is getting others to actually use it, that's the bit where you'd wonder whether it fully would. But I guess that's something that just takes a bit of time and becomes normal. You know, as we're saying about all these other things of the Qatar World Cup and how it'll get looked at eventually in time, it'll just look like a thing that happened. Yeah. Eventually, Wales being called Cymru instead of Wales will just be a thing that happened. It'll be like, eventually it'll be, oh, you used to say Wales. Oh, I see. Look at Rhodesia and Zimbabwe and all this. You know, these things change. Generations change. People still of a generation will refer to them old name. But gradually that will move on. So I guess it takes time, but you have to start it somewhere, don't you?
Yeah, I think that's a perfect point, though. I mean, this sort of stuff happens all the time and you barely notice it. I mean, look at, I think Czech Republic have recently changed their name to Czechia. I mean, look at countries like Macedonia, which we now refer to as North Macedonia. Yeah. Like, yeah, these things happen all the time. I think it's important to protect that cultural heritage. And I think language especially is something so important and intrinsic to a country's identity that I think to reflect that in sport and, you know, on the high profile stages, I think that's great. I think it's important.
And their identity really helps them as the natural underdog. They are the natural underdog to England, and they've been almost oppressed in centuries gone by the English regimes. And I think that actually helps them when they're the underdog in a match. I think they harness that, and that's what them sort of Michael Sheen motivational speeches are all about. It's about harnessing that feeling of being the underdog and being almost proud to be the underdog and overcoming the odds. And if anything that harnesses that feeling and helps them on the pitch, off the pitch, politically, whatever it is for the future, I wish them all the best.
Yeah, absolutely. It'll be an interesting one to see. It's something I think they've said they'll, in terms of football anyway, post-World Cup to try and do in the new year. So that'll be interesting to see how that goes and what difference it makes and how Wales referred to go, or sorry, Cymru are referred to going forward. You know, I've already made the mistake. I'm of that generation, clearly. Right, well, we'll start to wrap things up there. Look, Stephen, you are a prolific writer and I wanted to give you the opportunity just to mention what you've been doing with your books lately, because it's been a while since you've had you on and I know they've been going from strength to strength.
Oh, yeah, thanks, Aid. Yeah, my third book has been... out on the market now 6 months. It's Dynamite and Dave, the explosive lives of the British Bulldogs. It's about the sort of notorious and famous or slightly infamous wrestlers that were the British Bulldogs from Wigan, Lancashire, so north, from a northern English mining town, just like myself. So I've got that bit of shared heritage with them. I knew the story from being a childhood fan. Got to know the story over a lot of years, realised that they had a unique and sensational, tragic, triumphant story. That's the sort of thing that I love to study and research and write about. It has, as you put it, gone from strength to strength. I've ended up in places that I never thought I'd end up, you know, childhood heroes inviting me to have a drink with them so they can congratulate me, and Brett the Hitman Hart and Mick Foley writing a long and ridiculously positive review on his social media. It wasn't what I thought it would turn into, but it has done. And so, yeah, I just wanted to give it a mention here because it's sort of a listenership that I wouldn't have reached yet with the publicity that I've been doing. So, yeah, if anybody's interested in that, go and check it out. Thank you.
See, Matthew, you know, I think in your future, I can see some sort of political football type study piece of work coming.
Oh man, that's too big. I don't think I could handle that responsibility.
Never say never. That's all I'd say. Never say never. Well, let's wrap it all up there for tonight then, chaps. Thank you both for your contributions. It's great to have you back on, and it won't be so long again before we have you on again. Cheers, guys.
Thanks, mate.
Yeah, cheers. See you soon.
And thank you for everyone for listening too. And do join us again next time on the LARP podcast from These Football Times. Thank you and bye.
Many thanks for joining us today on the LARP, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.